the midweek drive, zooming into the future and energized by the now.
So we are in the National Portrait Gallery, and we've been taken to the contemporary art wing of the gallery.
Yes, indeed. This is, in fact, the 20th and 21st century. Of course, they overlap. And this is reframing women and also self-portraits. And if we look on the walls, we see quite a lot of famous individuals. Some, in fact, go back to the 19th century. And contemporary ones, including two artists, Sarah Lucas and Tracy Emin, who is extremely well-known. If we look through here, we find Sylvia Pankhurst, who was the famous suffragette. A lot of these names are not well known. Indeed, I'd never heard of a lot of them. The purpose in revamping the National Portrait Gallery was to make it fit for purpose in the 21st century. Now, that has meant not only a complete rehang, but also a total change in attitudes towards women. There are certain rooms and certain walls painted with portraits or photographs. Photography, very interestingly, is given a equal billing with portraiture, which I think is only fair because it is a form of portraiture, and they're so very different. They complement each other. It's not that they're opposed. Many have considered them opposed in the past, but especially since portraiture dates from throughout the ages, and photography usually the 1850s onward or thereabouts. But what is interesting here is it is a deliberate attempt to bring famous and also not so famous women to prominence, but and also make it more diverse, more persons of colour, to enhance photography and also video, which is important, as in the Sleeping David Beckham, say. There are a few examples, not that many. And everything from death masks to everything you can think of, with very, very few. There's very little photorealism that I've spotted. That has been very popular in what used to be an annual exhibition, the BP Portrait Award. It no longer exists, at least isn't currently in its present form, but you would find that at one time photorealistic portraits tended to win the top prize. It's interesting to see there are very, very few here. What you've got is a total mix. This room, again, is devoted just to women, and there are other galleries there which are likewise.
How important is it to have women representation when it comes to self-portraits?
I think it's important to have, and this is basically an overall comment, to have a correct representation of women when it comes to the fact that you are in this gallery looking back from this, down from the 16th century to our own era, where women, where it was most of it, and you could argue some of it still is a patriarchy, but where you do find that women, having been largely eliminated from the story from time to time, are given equality, some would say more than equality. But it is important to remember there are three queens, Elizabeth I, Victoria, and Elizabeth II, the three most famous, I would say, all were women. So in a way, there's an imbalance here, but it's deliberate. And also you get an insight into British imperial rule, which is far from flattering. You get an insight also into the atrocity of slavery, but it isn't something that distracts you from, as the Tate Britain rehang, in my opinion, does, the actual works on show. Rather, it's part and parcel of it, and I fear part and parcel of a pretty terrible story. But with the ups and downs, looking through these galleries, you can follow British political, social, and cultural history, and I think remarkably well.
Well, and I think it also provides a sense of transparency, too, especially from a perspective that's usually denied when talking about historical moments. I wanted to ask you guys, is there something that stood out to you since being in this room? Anything that's caught your eye that you're curious about? Or just you take a liking to?
Actually, I like this woman up here. The is it potentially a kimono that she's wearing?
It looks like it, yeah.
Some sort of, like, the sashes that you have in Spain and Portugal. Mm. But I think that is really elegant and the colors are beautiful.
Yeah, she's very much in a kind of neutral tone, but the garment itself is popping with color.
Mm.
Yeah. What? How does it make you feel, I guess, when you look at it?
As though you can be proud of who you are. She's proud and dominate and showing who she is. So you feel like you can almost mirror that and be proud of who you are and go, yes, I can be just like that.
Mm-hmm. Would you ever do your own kind of portrait, I guess? Would you have commission or either take your own self-portrait of whether it's photographed or drawn?
Photographed. I've had quite a few headshots done. I don't know if you can count headshots.
Hey, I mean, how do you think that represents you as, well, not just as an artist, but as yourself? Sorry, didn't mean to put you on the spot there. Well, I guess let's talk about it as an artist. What are you trying to convey when you do a headshot for your music?
For a lot of some of the acting as well, I try and portray different characters. So I can be this serious person, I can be this smiley person, I can be this domineering person, just like in the photo. But it's also for the music, when you're looking at your covers and designing the covers, mm-hmm. then you want to not only represent yourself, but also tell the story of the song that you're singing.
All right, yeah. And have you guys also had your own portraits made or any photographs of yourself?
Well, I haven't. My mother was a portrait painter, and so she painted me. Though, alas, she died when I was young, but it is a fascinating experience, and also it's an interesting experience to see. There's a very special dialogue between the sitter and the artist, and it's quite interesting for us as spectators to guess sometimes or have our own interpretations of what the artist actually thought of the sitter and how the sitter likes to be depicted, what background, what clothes, and so on. And also portraitures, we've been holding a mirror up to nature because, of course, it mirrors trends in our society. And interestingly, too, it's been the way down the centuries since the Egyptian funerary portraits, and also quite a number of Roman emperors before realism was abandoned for centuries. Was so much religious art that was stylized. Portraiture was the way that you depicted individuals, you depicted the trends, you depicted that period. Now, of course, since the 19th century, of course, it's photography and portraiture, and that is what this gallery now represents.
Mm. And, sorry.
I'd love to draw your attention to this painting, which is Emily Pankhurst. Sylvia, isn't it? Or is it Emily?
Sylvia
Pankhurst, who, middle class, and yet here is depicted as a working class woman, as it says here, like her followers. How genuine do you think that was? How was she genuine? Or was she just clever at media and how to portray herself in order to get support from all classes?
I think it's clear from the date where that was pastel, 1907 to 10. Of course, she was involved in the struggle for women's rights, and as a result, that would clearly have been an artificial attempt, if you like, to enlarge her image, to spread the word.
But couldn't it be both as well? I mean, you know, just you can't exactly help where you're born. It's a random luck at that point, right? I mean, I could have been born to a lower class in India with the amount of population, if we're going by numbers. But just because she wasn't raised from a lower class, the work that she also provided or she went into was for a variety of classes for women.
Yeah, I'm not knocking her. I'm certainly not, because I think what she stood for and what she did has been enormous and important. I just wonder how she had time to think that one out. And I actually like the portrait too. I think it's absolutely fabulous and very, very innocent, earnest.
Well, again, it says an effort to align herself with the working class, rather like an image of a politician today. So you have various aspects of your character, or if it isn't your character. Fair enough, it's artificial, but it helps to spread the word, and some people, well, all right, some would be cynical, but it's obviously it was the mass of people she wanted to attract, and of course it took a long time to have equality. And as for true equality, well, I think there are over 60 women MPs in the House of Commons, but I'm not sure of the actual number.
It's appalling, isn't it?
It is still nothing like what it should be, and it may well be more than that. I'm not certain of that number. But there's no doubt that the first was Countess Markowitz in the 19th century, but she was Sinn Féin and didn't take her seat because she wouldn't swear allegiance to the Queen. The well-known first woman to take her seat was Lady Astor.
American.
American, who had a particular hatred, it was reciprocated, of Winston Churchill.
Don't I know?
Churchill, if I was your wife, she once said, I would drink poison. And he replied, Madam, if I was your husband... Oh, sorry, Churchill, if I was your wife, I would give you poison. Churchill replied, Madam, if I was your husband, I would drink it.
And I think that explains the relationship beautifully.
Well, we'll leave that there with Cathy Manso clearly having addressed the issue of the Anglo-American relationships of Lady Astor, of course. That, of course, taking place at the National Portrait Gallery, which is where we send off Cathy and Graham and Victoria to actually do their little stuff, whilst I was actually getting some messages at the Covent Garden base. Enough of such stuff. It is our feature, which we call Author of the Week. We've got Jessica Burtis with us as well, which is fantastic stuff there. And Jessica, absolutely fantastic bonus time. We have the legendary agent responsible for so many of our top authors that we feature regularly here on Siren Radio, the Midweek Drive. It's Mickey Mickelson with us.
Hi, everybody.
So, Mickey, let's start off you've made a fairly major career decision recently because you've now moved full-time into the representative industry. You've left your standard day job in many ways. How much of a kind of challenge was that, or was that something you always had as part of the grand scheme?
You know, it's funny. I've actually resigned from that company, and I've decided to... It was an experiment in translation. I did it for 3 months. Prior to that, when I formed Creative Edge, I was working full-time in the corporate sector for over 3 years. I was on the road traveling 6 days a week, servicing Alberta and Saskatchewan credit unions, and then doing Creative Edge part-time. Mergers happened. They eliminated my position. I made the decision to go full-time, and then I wanted to save some extra funds recently and get things figured out financially from that aspect. I've got a girl I'm going to be getting married to in South Africa, so I wanted to get some money around that and save those things. So I worked in this company for 3 months. I loved it, but ultimately what I found was I wasn't able to devote the time that I wanted to my business. And so I had to make a really hard and difficult decision. Do I continue going this route and seeing where it leads, or rebuild and reformulate and put everything back into my business, which is what I love to do? I've been doing this for 6+ years. I have over 100 authors I represent. I have New York Times bestsellers. I have USA Today bestsellers. I have international bestsellers. I wasn't about to throw that away on something that might be or may not be good down the road. So I made the conscious decision to go back to this on a full-time basis and not digress with that and continue to build up my clients and my client base, but as well help service my immediate affiliates like yourselves. So I know it's a long answer, but I just want to get that out there.
Absolutely. We wanted to actually address that. Now, for the benefit of, this might well include Jessica as well, the listener who aren't familiar with Creative Edge. I mean, I would say we sometimes name check you, obviously, when we're doing authors, and we obviously get a nod with respect to that, etc. But just explain, you know, why you serve that wonderful interface between the creator, the writer, the author, the musician, whatever they may sort of be doing, or the artist, and of course the external world, to actually ensure that their product blossoms.
You know, it's funny that you asked me that question, and thank you for that. And by the way, hello, Jessica. Again, nice to see you. I like being in the middle of things between this. I like being Sweden or Switzerland, if you want to call it that. I really enjoy working with my people. I think they're some of the most talented people in the literary and musical and, I guess, entertainment arts. But beyond that, I get the best of both worlds because I can help them get the coverage that they need in all kinds of forms, podcast, book reviews, TV, radio, print, all of that. But in beyond that, I also get to work with some valuable media affiliates that I've built relationships with, much like here. I think I've been working with you for over 4 years or something to that effect. And that's what we're all about, is relationship building on a long-term longevity purpose. We're not interested in what I call commodity relationships, meaning 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, even a year. To me, it doesn't do anything. Anybody I sign or anybody I work with, I want to have a long-standing relationship with, because I think that those relationships are the ones that ultimately will work for both sides, mm-hmm. if that makes any sense.
It's certainly, I think, the way forward to actually ensure that you build those solid foundations, because as I'm sure most people will attest to, there is so much flim-flam around in all aspects of the entertainment business, and it adds to that the kind of panics of the likes of ChatGPT, artificial intelligence, and so on and so forth. I think actually having some kind of, not solidity, because it, I mean, solidity implies that it's not changing, but an evolving area where you've got a constancy, perhaps a constancy rather than a solidity, that actually, you know, ensures that things work through effectively. And then, yeah, obviously there are sometimes things happen, events occur, and so on and so forth. I don't think any of us were expecting the pandemic, for instance, but that took us into this whole new world where, you know, from being basically telephonic links on a weekly basis with Madrid Drive, now, of course, we have visual links from that point of view. So, again, it opens up in a whole range of sort of ways. Jessica, over to yourself. Questions, please.
Yeah, I would actually really like to know how you got into publicity and working with authors.
One of my client friends that I worked with in the corporate world, she wrote a book, and we were on a tour together through Alberta. And she talked to me about this book, and we're in this car and we're driving around and we're meeting with credit unions and we're doing our corporate stuff. And her name is Miranda Oh. And I used to work for Chapters Indigo in a special events coordinator role for about 2 years. And they're the largest bookstore chain in Canada. And so I said to her, "Hey, Miranda, do you want some help getting some signings?" And she's like, "Yeah." So we did like 8 signings on that same trip in Alberta. And she sold a ton of books. And I helped her with how to talk to people in book signing roles and things like that. And word started to get out. And some of the authors that I'd worked with when I was at Chapters heard about this. And they said, "Well, Mickey, how about you do the same thing for me?" That was in March of 2016. So I went from one client in March of 2016 to over 34 by August of that same year. And next thing you know, we're starting to sign some mainstream media or traditionally published authors as well. Robert J. Sawyer, who's one of the largest science fiction authors out there, he probably is the biggest. He's won every major science fiction award. He reached out to me because I knew him from Chapters. And like, "Hey, Mickey, do you want to work with me?" So it all blossomed up. And now we're at where we're at today. So it's crazy.
And what kind of book?
What's going to happen? Sorry, go ahead.
No, truly. It's fascinating that it happened so quickly and what can kind of just chance come about.
Yeah, I mean, and this is me being ultimately honest and transparent because that's how I talk to my team and my media affiliates and everything else. Have I made mistakes? Absolutely. Have I lost clients? Absolutely. But I believe that we're always growing and we're always changing and we're always going to make mistakes. But we're also going to celebrate successes. And I've done a combination of both those things, if that makes any sense.
It does. I'm actually curious about what books you read for fun as well on your own time.
Oh, the question you put me on the spot, Jessica. Thank you so much for that.
I had to. I'm sorry. It's like choosing a favorite child, I know.
I'll be honest, I do read a little bit in terms of fiction and novels. If I'm going to read a book, it's going to be a classic type of book. I finished Moby Dick 2 months ago, but really my goal and my passion is actually comic books. I'm a huge comic book fanatic. I love the Golden Age. I love the Silver Age. I love all of that stuff. So, and for me, it's a timing thing as well, because it doesn't take too long to read a 22-page comic and get involved in the heroes and all of that. But when you're getting into a novel, there's time you need to take to embellish that. And I've tried to read a couple of books, and I was unable to finish them just due to my own busy schedule and everything like that, if that makes any sense. Yeah.
It does. Yeah, comic books, I'm glad that they're kind of getting more attention because they can be so immersive, especially with the visuals. I just finished a few volumes of Deadly Class, so
Oh yeah.
it's fun getting into them.
Yeah, I mean it's a whole new industry, and comics are not just for kids anymore, right? They're just not. And with the films out there and the focus and the comic book conventions, it's a billion-dollar industry. So there's lots of geeky comic book fans like myself out there, but that's definitely my passion for sure.
I was intrigued, Mickey, to see that recently, or maybe not so recently, but you've actually moved from the actual physical comic books to these kind of areas where it's all on a DVD-ROM or a computer-based system. So, in terms of that, and with comiXology and other areas within that, I mean, there is that argument. It's a bit like when we talk to people about, do you prefer the book in hand, the physicality of that book, or do you prefer it when it's all on screen and you can zoom in and zoom out? And obviously, with comiXology, you can almost use the app to actually move from panel to panel in a kind of, mini motion picture like way. I mean, what's your preference for that? Or would you still say that actually, as long as it's the story and the art, that's ultimately what you're going for?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because I tend to like the digital aspect of it and have that transportability and the ability to zoom in and zoom out and read all those things and admire the art on a large TV, which you can do today. But I also buy the books in slab form, which of course they're authentically graded, they're more valuable from a collector's standpoint. And so I get the best of both worlds because I have the slabs and then I have the comic. I can actually enjoy it, but it still retains its and increases its value from that aspect. So there's lots of collectors like me that do that.
And although you've actually moved, I think, some of your comic books into the digital format, you're still hanging on to your Beatles albums, I believe.
I will never sell my Beatles albums. Go John, Paul, George, and Ringo.
It's curious.
Love them.
I was actually listening to some of Julian Lennon's material recently. Again,
Yeah.
obviously, Saltwater, a very poignant moment. And I often thought, in a real sense, slightly disappointing that he never kind of got together with obviously Paul and George, and maybe it was just a case of, well, the son could never replace the father. But I would have thought that would have been an opportunity, I would have thought.
It's amazing, Alex. I can't even imagine the life that Julian Lennon lived and just living up to his dad and going through all the mayhem and the turmoil that they went through. It's mind-boggling, and kudos to him for still being successful and getting music out there, really, to be honest, because I mean, I don't even know what I would do if I was Julian Lennon. I mean, going through all that with the divorce between John and Cynthia and all that, and then his dad's own death, and then trying to rebuild those strained relationships with Paul and all that, it had to be tough. Had to be.
Last week, of course, we were speaking to Ido van Belkom,
Yes.
fantastic soul, etc., and key author. We talked very much about how he, with respect to Wolfpack, of course, hopefully there will be a second season, etc. But that
Hopefully.
interesting notion about how Hollywood gets hold of the package, they change it, they interpret it, often sometimes to everybody's satisfaction. But again, the key point that came out of that particular discussion was the whole notion of the importance, and I say again, the importance of the writer. And of course, we are seeing at present within Hollywood, the writer strike, now followed by the Screen Actors Guild and the AFTRA strike, etc. Big issues relating to that. Indeed, we spoke recently on a Midweek Drive. I mean, Jessica was on the show, basically. We were listening to Armin Shimerman and Annette Andre, whose husband, Arthur Weingarten, and I always say Jessica's the recipient of the first ever Arthur Weingarten Contributor of the Year Award for the Midweek Drive. But Arthur was a script writer who wrote for the Green Lantern, for not Green Lantern, Green Hornet, for Wild Wild West, for Man from U.N.C.L.E., for a whole, the Addams Family, whole range of aspects. But, you know, he was deeply concerned about the way in which that technology is impacting this. And again, I think certainly from Annette's perspective, he would have been devastated in many ways. He just passed a year or so ago. But, you know, about how things are happening. From your own perspective, because let's face it, like Jessica, you're both in North America. Is this something which you think are concerned? You know, is it a matter of concern? Or is it something that, well, last time was the writer's strike in the noughties, we got more reality television. Great. What's your own feeling, Mickey, with respect to obviously the concerns that writers and indeed actors obviously have and creatives about that side of the industry and ChatGPT as well?
I'm going to answer this very, very carefully because I think it's a delicate question. I believe that there's going to, and I've already seen a bit of this, there's going to be independent companies out there pitching those self-published authors because they have wild dreams about getting their books into to film and all that. They're going to pitch these self-published authors and basically say, because of this strike, we have this and we can get your book out to there, but it's going to cost you money. So please pay us and we'll get your book made into a film, independent film, and you'll have all kinds of success. I've had four clients this week alone who have been pitched that way. And I shut it down right away because number one, you should never have to pay money to somebody to get your product made out into a screenplay or something like that. This strike is definitely game changing for now, but it's not going to stay like that forever. If people tell me that Hollywood's going to stop, just stop. No, they will find a way to make this work out. And when that happens, they're going to be looking for content. If your book is solid, if it's got a decent cover, if you're marketing it well, if you have sales in place and your story is legit and your branding is professional, albeit traditional or indie, you have as good a chance as anybody to get your film made into a, get your book made into a film, and you shouldn't have to pay money to do that. So I'm really glad that you asked me this question. I know I went off track a little bit, but it just frustrates me to no end how people prey on the indie author over this whole film, screenplay, TV aspect, because it takes years. And I could talk for an hour on this.
Well, Jessica, of course, just in the process of writing her master's dissertation. She's exploring from that point of view. I also maintain she will write the great American novel one of these days. But I mean, again, from young authors, et cetera, Jessica, any thoughts in terms of what Mickey's been saying? And of course, the very valuable advice that be very, very, very careful if anybody says, yeah, we'll do this. Just send in this paycheck or this particular amount of money and we'll do it for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it seems like anytime there is a chance for money to be made, there will be someone who will try to take advantage of people for it. And I think that hearing about that and hearing you say that about how it's never, you should never be in that situation is nice to hear, because even with academic journals, we would get our professors telling us, you know, there's predatory journals and then there's ones that truly care about what they put out, and making those distinctions is so important. I think especially because right now there's so much talk, I feel like, in a lot of reading circles about the book industry and, you know, shops and signings, and people worried that, you know, Amazon is kind of taking over books, and that maybe books aren't really going to stay popular and that it might be kind of fading. But I'm really curious about your thoughts about that, actually, when you hear those debates.
Amazon is the catalyst, and I don't want to tick Amazon off because all my clients are on there, so I'm not going to slam Mr. Bezos today, but Amazon is the catalyst for everything. It's definitely a key marketing aspect for anybody else, but there are other things that authors can do to have just as much success. I have authors all the time saying, well, Mickey, I need this Amazon review. Okay, why does every review have to be on Amazon? You're telling me that a place like Publishers Weekly is not going to provide value for you? Who doesn't post on Amazon, but they're the largest trade reviewer in the United States. So there's different things that we can do and different things that are definitely key cogs in this industry. I think the important thing to do as a writer is, again, to make sure that your brand looks professional, to make sure the book cover is vibrant, to make sure that the book has been professionally edited. And yeah, there's money that authors are going to have to spend to make that happen. But that's the key difference between the authors who want to be a success and the authors who feel that they're entitled to the success because they put out this book. And there's a big difference there. And I've always said this, if you're an indie author and you've done all this work and you've spent this money and you've done everything right, you have every reason to be up there in terms of success, in terms of press coverage, in terms of media aspects, in terms of book sales, as the ones that are traditionally published, the big four as well.
And do
does
you
that
have any
question?
No, it definitely does. I think having that, like, seeing them the same way, I think is very nice to hear, because I think a lot of people do make, at least a lot of readers, it seems, will make a big difference between someone who's published from a big four and then indie authors. But in the end, it's nice that everyone wants to just have their passion on a page and to engage with the reader.
Exactly. And the important thing for authors too is to determine where their money is going to be best spent. I personally don't think spending $4,000 to a screenplay company to write your screenplay for a film that will never be made is probably a waste of money. Whereas you can utilize that $4,000 and pay a really good publicist, of which I am one, but please don't contact me, everybody. I'm just saying, there are different things that authors can do to gauge where their money is going to have success with their books. And sometimes ads are the way to do that. Other times it's media connections. Other times it's a publicist. It's all about what the author wants to do, but they really have to be smart when they're spending money on promotion. That's my belief.
And for someone who really would like to get into that production side of it and work in book publicity, how would they go about, maybe what advice would you have for them?
Well, I never went to school for book publicity, actually. I went to the Northern Alberta Institute of Technology and I got a business diploma in marketing. So, but my advice would be, anybody who's trying to do this, be legitimate, be truthful to yourself. You have to have passion for it. You have to be able to work with different personalities and different egos and different scopes, because authors, musicians, they all have different attitudes, and what they're looking to do is all different. So you're wearing different hats every single day. Some people will say that they're publicists, but what they do is they simply just write a press release and then they send it on a newswire and then they tell their client, oh, and by the way, I got you on Fox News. Well, actually, you didn't. You got the press release posted to their internal site where some journalists might see it and they might cover you. By the way, 1% of people, that's what actually happens. But they didn't get them on Fox News. So be legitimate.
Right.
Don't charge money up front when you're having conversations with people. Be open and honest to do what you can do and what you can't do. 50% of the people I meet on a daily or monthly basis, I usually talk between 5 and 10 authors every single month. One of the first things they say is, I want to be a New York Times bestseller, or I want to be on the Oprah Book Club. Okay, what are you going to do that? Because if you're a debut indie author and your book doesn't look traditionally published, the chances of either of those things happening is almost nil. And so you have to have those hard conversations as well. Yeah.
Yes.
Within the creative world, Mickey, one area that we haven't really discovered or discussed really, I mean, we've discovered it, obviously, but in terms of the game playing industry, the gaming industry, which apparently, if you look at the numbers, has eclipsed Hollywood for a few years now in terms of the money that it's raising, etc. Is that an area that you've developed? I mean, obviously, there are elements of Robert Sawyer's work that could easily be transferred to gaming aspects and so on and so forth. Is that something that you look at in terms of transmedia storytelling and, again, the opportunities that are provided by immersive online multiple playing games?
I haven't myself. I used to represent some authors who have gone into that scope. It's definitely an area that is going to be growing. And depending how long this Hollywood strike goes, people are going to be looking for other contents beyond the film industry. And I think the film industry is going to take a bit of a hit over this strike, to be honest. It's hurting actors, it's hurting writers, it's actually hurting authors when you think about it. And so people will be looking at other areas. Have I investigated that myself? I'll be honest, I have not. But again, if one of my clients were to say, Mickey, I want to look at this and get a game made on it, I would do my very best to try and find contacts around all of that. So, I mean, never say never to anything, to be honest. We always have to be thinking outside the box.
One of the standard questions which we tend to bowl at authors, you may have actually heard it on various previous editions where we featured folk from your stable of creatives, etc. But I put it down to the nutrition question, basically, and specifically the North Carolina nutrition question. This is basically where Jessica comes to the fore. And I think now, Jessica, we have a chance to actually ask, you know, representative agent in terms of the significance of this particular aspect, which in Canada, he may not have even heard of this particular nourishing side of things. Over to you, Jessica.
We like to get an idea from the authors about if they have ever heard of or tried sweet tea, which is a favorite from my region in the US, or even boiled peanuts if we're getting adventurous.
No, I've never had either of those things. But I am adopting a taste bud for the South African foods because I was there in January because my fiance is there. So
what would be some of the dishes you would recommend?
Bok. Sheep is always delicious. Sheep is so delicious. And things like that. I mean, there was a rice thing that I don't know the name of it, but it was so, so good. And we have bop every morning plus jungle oats. And so it was really, 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 really cool.
It's interesting. It's obviously a Southern state thing, but I'm not sure whether bop possibly mixed with sweet tea or indeed boiled potatoes. As we recently found, of course, sweet tea in New York is even being sold as a boiled peanuts. Did I say boiled tea?
Yeah. Boiled potato.
Boiled potato, yes. Tea, I know. Look, I'm British, Jessica. What do you expect? I mean, I don't understand these
things.
I now
have to come and visit you and try this wonderful dish. That's all I have
to do. Exactly. Yes, most definitely.
So, we're here in 2023, Mickey. We're progressing sort of neatly. I mean, obviously, some might say the pandemic, it's all over and so on and so forth. There were, as we've talked about in the past, some bonuses about the pandemic. There was an opportunity that authors had a chance to immerse themselves. But I'm thinking about book festivals in particular. We've just come out of the New York Book Festival. Again, another successful event. And growing, run by Sarah Baltimore in New York, Nottinghamshire. And in terms of that, though, she was finding that there are a number of agents who are saying, actually, unless it's one of the major book festivals, i.e. the equivalent of Hay on Wye or possibly the Harrogate Crime Festival, or indeed, you know, arguably in terms of the San Diego Comic Con, fewer authors are kind of keen to get out and about in terms of meeting their clients and doing that sort of things. I mean, again, one turns back to Sebastian a few weeks ago, Sebastian de Castel, who was very keen and very enthusiastic about sort of working through that. But how are you finding this the sort of line with respect to authors? And it can also be an agency thing. Sometimes agents are actually saying, well, actually, you just do a straight interview on that one rather than actually go out and actually meet the client. Or how important would you see meeting the public, meeting the readership actually is in the life cycle of an author's production?
I am of the belief, and thank you for the question. I'm of the belief that authors still need to identify with their fans. Even at a book signing where you may only sell 5 to 10 books, you don't know what those 10 people are going to do with your book. They might tell 10 or 100 other people, and one of those 100 people might be a major influencer in the book world. We have no idea. I think festivals are key. I think it's important that authors go and meet their public, because unless they do that, how are the public going to actually know what kind of people they actually are? Because interviews can be, well,
manipulated.
They're only based on what the questions are asked, right? So unless you can have a heart-to-heart talk with an individual, you're never going to know what that author's about. One of my key focuses, and I'm starting to do this now, is trying to get more authors into the library circuit, because the libraries are a key way for their fans to come out and meet them. But then you're also networking with key influencers in major book space, because libraries are a major book space. So on-site events are always going to be an important factor. I challenge anybody, any publicist, any book related person to tell me otherwise, because you can never not win when you're meeting with your fans on a one-on-one basis. That's my belief.
Jessica, any closing thoughts from yourself, or possibly sort of share with us how your dissertation is going?
The dissertation is going, it's going. But I would actually, I'm really curious if you would have any advice for authors who are starting out at the very beginning of kind of trying to really focus on writing a book that they want to have published.
Oh, there's so many things I could tell you, Jessica. Not have false expectations and believe that your book is going to be on the New York Times best-selling list. That's the first thing. Have real expectations. Understand that it's going to be work, not only writing it, but marketing it. Marketing it will be probably the largest hurdle a writer will face. Writing the book for writers is pretty easy. You go through some edits, you get the story on paper, and then it's out there. The hardest part to me is the marketing of that product and how you can get some success doing that. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is, if a writer is going to write a book, make sure it's done right. Get a decent editor. Don't hire your friend to do your book cover. Because it happens all the time. Oh. You have no idea. It's crazy. And in fact, don't hire your friends to do your edits for you. And then don't just hire your friends to review it, because they're never going to tell you the truth. They're your friends. So that's my opinion, is get some people that are outside of your world to critique, to help edit, to help get it out there. And then, again, I'm biased, hire a publicist to help you market it. Because, I mean, that's just, you know, and hire a social media person. I have one. I have an affiliate in Houston, Texas, I work with on an ongoing basis, and she's an award-winning social media book marketing person, and things like that. So these are the things that should happen.
Becky, it's been, again, an insightful and fascinating half hour or so that we've actually spent sharing with your good self. We'll be heading back to Cathy Manso's On Location report with Richard Fitzwilliams and Graham Harper at the Actors' Church, actually, in Covent Garden, which they were sent off to recently to actually work through. But we have reached that stage where, Jessica, you need to put those last two questions to publicist extraordinaire from Creative Edge Course, Becky Mickelson.
Yes. Mickey, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today?
Absolutely. Always.
Amazing. And will you join us again soon?
If you have me, I'm here anytime you want. Thank you all both for your support as well. I appreciate it.
We are a rock revolving around a golden sun. We are a billion children rolled into one. So when I hear about the hole in the sky, salt water wells in me. climb the highest mountain. We'll make the desert bloom. We're so ingenious, we can walk on the moon. But when I hear of how the forests have died, salt water wells in my eyes. I have lived for love, but now that's not enough. Send photographs of Mars. We're so enchanted by how clever we are. Why should one baby feel so hungry? She cried. Salt water wells in my eyes.
Here in St. Paul's Church, and I'm speaking to...
Hi, I'm Ben. I'm the venue manager. Yeah, that'll do.
And what's happening here?
So we have got Henry I, which is part of our Theatre in the Garden season, which runs from a sort of May all the way through to September. This is Henry I, so this is a piece of new writing, Shakespearean in terms of its epicness, which tells the story of, after the death of William the Conqueror, what the brothers, the sons and the brothers did during that. And we've got a big piece of set. You guys can't see it, but you're probably going to take a photo.
Happy to. Yeah,
absolutely. Please take a photo. The guys are in here, busy moving around. The cast have just arrived. This is their first day of the show. And we've got the whole space filled with an exciting piece of new sets. It's the biggest piece of set we've ever had in the building.
So how long have you been working on this now? Or is today first day? And
so these guys, the poor guys, were in here on Tuesday from about 6 o'clock in the morning. There they go. The actors are all saying hello to each other. They've been in here from 6 on Tuesday, and the guys are going to be doing a get out till 1 o'clock in the morning on Saturday. So they are really going for it. They've worked really, really hard on this piece.
Yeah. Wow. And you said it's going on until September?
This isn't. No, so
no,
they're going
no,
to be
no.
come and gone.
Come and
so
gone.
So they've literally 3 days and then they're off.
3 days,
so it's remarkable what they've achieved. So they've achieved this in basically a day and a half, and they'll be totally clear by Sunday. You won't even know that they were here. It's incredible.
All right. That means this has to go out sooner than later, so we'll make sure to make it happen.
Yeah, but there's more in Theatre in the Garden. There's plenty more going on throughout the summer. Just find it on our website.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're
I really
welcome,
appreciate
folks.
Your time.
Do feel free to take a photo.
And Richard's now giving me a tour around St. Paul's Church. So what are we seeing?
There was a hiatus where...
It's actually a lot neater back here now than it was. They've been themselves because they start the actors' change.
the one we see here, the famous names, like Alan J. Lerner, for example, who was the lyricist of My Fair Lady. My Fair Lady, the opening scene, was set famously in Covent Garden, and that's where Henry Higgins, played by Rex Harrison in the film, meets Eliza, played by Audrey Hepburn on screen and Julie Andrews on stage, and that's in the front of the church, the pillars. And these, which include Peter O'Toole, and also most recently named Diana Rigg, these are special plaques which honour top performers. Well, that's why St. Paul's, which dates back to the 17th century, the architect was Christopher Wren, who did St. Paul's Cathedral. This was known as the finest barn in England because of its shape, and it is very famous. It's known as the Actors' Church, hence these tributes to famous performers.
That's so cool. Do you have any questions for Richard, since we can take advantage to ask all the questions we want now?
Do you have anybody that you think should be on these plaques?
Well, there are a large number who aren't, simply because they stopped for a while. And I mean, for example, Sir Donald Sindon, who is a very famous... Sir Donald Sindon, who was a well-known comedian, he has a bench outside, not a plaque. And this was a sort of compromise at some point, because they did stop this, and then with Peter O'Toole and Dame Diana Rigg and others, and June Whitfield, I see, they've continued it. It's a delightful tradition, and if you look on the other side, you find some really, really famous names. I mean, whether Thomas Arne, who composed Rule Britannia, or whether you have some absolutely top actors, very, very well known, as you can see. The Cassons were famous. I mean, these mightn't be household names today, but they were in their time, and they've been honoured in the church in this way. I mean, there we have Richard Briers, for example, who most people will know from The Good Life. Fenella Fielding, as I see gone up, which is nice. Sir Michael Redgrave, famous actor, although he did die some 40 years ago. So, as I say, there's a mix, but it's the link with the theatrical profession that the church is most famous for, and that's why it's so fascinating that they have a theatrical company, and as you see, they're making the most of the interior of the church.
And Graham Harper, now that we have you here as well, I can't imagine this being your first time in St. Paul's Church.
Do you know, it is my first time. I've known of it. I have family who've known of it and been part of the church, who are also actors, but not me. And what's interesting, Richard, is seeing Richard Briers, who is known for a big comedy series, but in fact he was a very serious, straight actor, and was famous for many Shakespearean plays as well as... Restoration and whatever. Most of the actors here are known for film star or being film stars, or whatever, but they were also very serious actors. It's quite extraordinary. Lovely to see their names.
Mix. Look at Ed and Terry.
Yeah. Very, very famous. Extraordinary. Yep. It's really nice to be here.
And of course, when we walked in, I didn't get a chance to get this recorded until now, but also your great, great, great. Great grandfather is four greats is also here.
Yes, there is a memorial to him by the sculptor Flaxman. Flaxman did a great number of famous individuals in the 18th century, and he was my great 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 grandfather was Edward Hall. He was an apothecary. He lived in Henrietta Street, Covent Garden, which is quite near where we've just had some drinks. And he was also the secretary of the Whig Club, from its foundation until his death in 1797. The Whigs at that time were the opposition party. Our politics was very corrupt. I mean, there were rotten boroughs in England until, I think, it was the 1830s. But in Westminster, there was a particularly fierce fight in 1784, where the Duchess of Devonshire canvassed famously for the Whigs. She was the last woman to do so until the suffragettes propelled women finally to the centre politically. And I mean, it has taken many, many years, and indeed you could still argue equality or full equality has not been achieved politically, but the Duchess of Devonshire's appearance, and this was recorded in a lot of cartoons of the period by Gilray and Rowlandson and others who were famous cartoonists, she knocked on doors and canvassed, and that was absolutely unique for a woman at that particular time. Edward Hall unfortunately died before the Whigs took office. That was because of George III's unrelenting hostility towards them, but nonetheless it did happen eventually under Charles James Fox.
So when was the first time you came to this church? When were you first introduced to find out a little bit about your own history?
Now, my father had researched this, so it was the 1970s that I saw it, and it is interesting. The monuments, of course, could do with a little restoration, but the problem is this church, despite its links with My Fair Lady, has never really had the profile it deserves and the funds it needs to clean all its monuments. The Queen visited, and hence the repaint. But it is a church where you find a lot of memorial services, for example, to actors and actresses and so forth as well.
Mm-hmm. Why was it chosen to become the Actors' Church?
I don't know the reason that the actors specifically chose this, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if it's some link to Charles II in some way, and the way the stage, obviously, Oliver Cromwell having banned plays, took off after the Restoration in 1660.